From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The National Book Critics Circle Awards were announced earlier this week. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from two of the winners. Edmund White won in the category of biography for his book about the French writer Jean Genet. Genet constructed a legend of himself as a golden thug and sexual outlaw, something that appealed to White as a young gay man from the middle class. The award for Best Nonfiction Book went to Alan Lomax for his book The Land Where the Blues Began. Lomax is one of America's pioneering folklorists. His recordings have documented the songs and stories of Leadbelly, Jelly Roll Morton, and Woody Guthrie. Also today, Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Reality Bites. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, the National Book Critics Circle Award for Best Biography of the Year went to Edmund White for his biography of Jean Genet. Until now, White had been best known for his autobiographical novels, A Boy's Own Story and The Beautiful Room Is Empty, chronicling the adolescence and coming of age of a gay man. White's writing has been very influenced by Genet, who is considered one of France's most original writers of the 20th century. Through Genet's books, he constructed a legend of himself as a thief, vagabond, and sexual outlaw. In the biography, Ed White tries to find the story of the real man. Genet lived from 1910 to 1986. He wrote five novels, including Our Lady of the Flowers, a volume of memoirs called Prisoner of Love, and several plays, including The Maids and The Balcony. I spoke with Ed White last November when his biography of Genet was just published. White never met Genet, but White's life was changed by Genet's writing.
First of all, it seemed to me swooningly beautiful. I mean, I think that he was somebody, for instance, I mean, I was a nice little middle-class boy, and I think had I not read Genet, I would have been alarmed by drag queens, sneered at them the way most middle-class gay guys did in those days. But because of Genet, I found something heartbreakingly beautiful and romantic about this whole sort of gay underworld, the world of hustlers, of drag queens, of petty thieves, and so on. So when I arrived in New York in 1962, I used to love to walk up and down Greenwich Avenue and see the people that middle-class gays dismissed as riffraff.
Did you seek out some of the squalor that Genet wrote about?
Well, yeah. I mean, I even tried to be in male pornography for a while. I mean, it was all ridiculously misfired. And I have a book of essays coming out next year. And one of the essays is one that I wrote at the time, which was never published in the 60s, called On Becoming a Model for Male Slut. I'm Becoming a Model for Male Smut or something like that. And none of it worked. All of my attempts join the underworld were horribly misfired. But anyway, I did find something very romantic and beautiful about it.
You know, I think one explanation about why your attempts to join the underworld misfired, I mean, if you look at two of your major literary influences, you have Genet influencing on you on one hand and Nabokov on the other.
That's true, right. But I mean, what they have in common is they're both dandies. I mean, they're both people who don't think of human society in collective terms, who see themselves as isolated individuals living outside the herd. And that very much rang a bell for me in those days, in the 60s, when my own sensibility was being formed. I think now, I mean, I have a much more of a collective sense of being a gay man amongst other gay people. But in those days, I felt very isolated, and I liked that aspect of their work.
Your biography of Genet opens in the outhouse, and I'd like you to read the beginning of chapter one.
Thank you. Somebody said the other day in Vogue magazine that this must be the strangest beginning of any big book. As a child in the village of Aligny-en-Morvan, southwest of Dijon, Genet liked to spend hours in the outhouse, There were two outhouses, one close to the big stone house with the slate roof, the other 20 paces across the vegetable garden and next to the school wall. It was in this less convenient, more remote cell that he passed hours daydreaming and reading. And this is a quote from one of his books. The memory with the quickest sting is of the toilet outside the house with the slate floor. It was my refuge. Life, which I perceived as distant and blurred through its shadow and smell, a softening smell in which the odor of elder trees and the rich earth predominated, since the outhouse was all the way at the end of the garden, near the hedge, life reached me as singularly sweet, tender, light, or rather lightened, stripped of its heaviness. I speak of this life which consisted of the things outside the toilet, the remainder of the world, everything that wasn't my little hideout of boards riddled by insects. Life seemed to me to float a bit like a painted dream, while I, in my hole, like a larva, took up a peaceful, nocturnal existence. And sometimes I had the feeling I was slowly sinking deeper, as in a sleep, or a lake, or a maternal bosom, or even an act of incest, toward the spiritual center of the world.
Why did you begin there, in the outhouse?
Because I feel that Genet was somebody who was essentially and deeply solitary. Solitary to the point that he was always surrounded by a kind of invisible shell that protected him from contact with other people. And I wanted to show that there was this theme in his life that when he was a boy, he was in the outhouse listening to the world, observing it, but not seeing it, but hearing it, imagining it, thinking of it. But in this totally solitary space of his own. Later, he was in prison and again tried to imagine the life and loves of purely fictive characters that he invented. And he wrote his first two novels in prison and the other three in the shadow of prison, in the sense that he was always afraid of being arrested again and given life imprisonment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edmund White, and he's written a new biography of Jean Genet. Genet never knew his father. His mother abandoned him when he was a child, so he became a ward of the state in France. He went to reform school and then later to prison. What were the crimes he was charged with committing, and what were his sentences?
Genet liked to darkly hint that he was a real big-time criminal, and he even said to an interviewer who interviewed him late in life, you can ask me anything you want, but don't ask me if I ever murdered someone. But in fact, when we plumbed into the realities of Genet's criminal record, we found he'd stolen 4 bottles of aperitif, he'd stolen a fabric sample, he'd stolen a luxury edition of Verlaine's poems, Fête Galante, he'd stolen the autographs of 2 French kings, he had stolen another book, he had doctored his train ticket, and he'd stolen fabric samples twice. I have just listed his entire crimes.
Right, so he's not among the world's most hardened criminals.
Cocteau, who discovered Genet and first got him published in the 1940s, said, "Look, you're a very great writer and a terrible thief. Please, please stop stealing."
His writing about prison has a certain erotic power. I mean, in his fiction, he found an erotic power in prison. What about his real life experience of prison?
I think his real life experience of prison was pretty miserable, but I think that the secret about Genet is that the one emotion he never wanted to solicit from the reader was pity. I think he was terrified of appearing pitiful in anyone's eyes. He was very proud, and I start my book actually with a quotation from Kierkegaard, in which he says that there's this kind of person who's passed so far away from God into sin that even if God were to now appear before him and forgive him for all his sins, he wouldn't want to be forgiven. He wants to rage against the whole world, because only by doing so can he prove to himself that he's in the right. And I think that's really crucial to Genet. So Genet pictures, I mean, if you look at, for instance, there's a whole tradition of prison poetry in France, but the other prison poets are all people who are saying, "Oh, I'm sad, you are happy because you're outside the prison. I didn't really commit the crime. Please release me. I want to join you. I see a little dog walking by on the street outside the prison bars. Why can't I be?" Genet is entirely the opposite of this. He says, look, you're a jerk, you reader, and you're leading this boring middle-class life, and we guys in prison are all having fabulous sex and this very rich, hierarchical, marvelous existence that is like something out of the Middle Ages.
How interested were you in finding out about Genet's real sex life and how that compared to the sexuality of his fictional characters?
Well, I was interested in every way trying to figure out what was the difference between Genet's legend as he presented it and what was the truth. And that was certainly one aspect of it, because I was able to interview for hours and hours and hours, days and days, one of his lovers named Java, who appears as a character in Thief's Journal and who is a very frank and open guy, and who told me that most of Genet's sexuality was in his head, that he didn't like really having sex very often. He loved to write about it. Once in a while, he would go out when they were living in a little hotel room together in Montmartre and hire a hustler, but it was all sort of quickly done. He didn't really like sex that much, but he loved to talk about it.
How did Genet get interested in literature? Because the life that you're describing is so much the life of somebody who you'd think would be cut off from the world of literature.
Well, I think that when he was a boy, he was the number one student in the village. He was the person that was the leading student in the whole county, and was considered very brilliant, was constantly reading, and who was the priest's favorite choir boy because he spoke Latin with the best accent and memorized the verses best. So he's not at all the sort of tough little criminal child that he liked to picture later. He was, in fact, a sissy. And like a classic gay boy sissy, he was somebody who didn't want to work, didn't like to play with boys, but rather he liked to play with dolls, with girls, and who liked to dress up, was interested in the mass, in ceremonies in general, and was a tremendous daydreamer who didn't have very many friends, and who liked to go off into the fields with a cow, and while the cow grazed, he sat and read books. Later, when he was sent to reform school, he wasn't allowed to study because Maitre had a very sinister injunction against teaching the boys anything that might give them ideas above their station. But somehow or other, Genet got his hands on the poems by the Renaissance French poet Ronsard and memorized them, as he would later do in prison with the plays of Racine. So that Genet was somebody who very freely in conversation could introduce whole stanzas of poetry from the great classics. Then he was 6 years in the army, and that's a period in his life that he always concealed because he didn't like to admit that he'd done something so normal as be a soldier. But while he was in the army, he was stationed in a very boring French town called Toul. And there he read all of Dostoevsky and a lot of contemporary fiction and even began a literary correspondence with other writers.
You write how in the later part of Genet's life he took up the cause of the Black Panthers in the United States, of the PLO, but gay rights was never high on his list of causes. Do you know why not?
Well, I think that he didn't rank it as being so important. I mean, I think, in other words, he... First of all, I think he's somebody who, when he was queried by the gay German writer Hubert Fichte in the 1970s, Fichte said, "Do you mean to say when you were a young guy, you were a hustler and you used to beat up other gay people? Didn't you have any feeling of solidarity toward other gays?" And Genet said, "Not at all." And he says, "And you're being absurd if you expect me, as a peasant boy in the 1930s in France, if you expect me then to have had the kind of sophisticated political consciousness that you have now in the 1970s in Germany." So I think he's quite right. I mean, he is showing us that before gay liberation, people didn't have much of a feeling of solidarity with other gays. And Genet never experienced his sexuality as a collective thing, as I mentioned earlier. He always felt that it was something unique and personal and solitary.
My guest is Edmund White, author of a biography of Jean Genet. More after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Ed White is my guest. In a New York Times Magazine article that you wrote a few years ago on gay fiction, you said perhaps no other body of literature is as subject to political pressure from within the community as gay fiction is. Does that relate to Genet at all? Has he been seen as not being good for gay writers, or as very important, as a very important part of gay fiction? Yeah, in other words, have there been kind of political reasons to like or not like Genet?
I don't think he's had much of an influence on American gay theorists. I think that most of the important gay theorists have taken a longer look at Proust, let's say, than at Genet. But maybe I like to think my book might get people talking about it and thinking about it. I think Genet has a lot to teach people about sexuality.
Getting back to your comment about pressure from within the gay community on people who write gay fiction, did you feel subjected to any of that pressure, either in deciding to write a biography on Genet or in your interpretation of him?
Well, it's interesting. While I was working on it, Larry Kramer gave an interview to The Advocate in which he said that the only acceptable thing for any gay writer in the world to be doing now was to write about AIDS. And he said, Edmund White, of all things, is writing about Genet. But the other day I talked to Larry and he said, oh, well, now I've read your book and I think it was worth your while. I'm glad you did it. So I thought that was very nice of him. I wasn't disturbed that he said it anyway. I mean, it just seemed to me that we can't all do the same thing. And there are AIDS activists and who are writing about that. I wanted to write about Genet because as somebody who's HIV positive himself, I like to be reminded that there are other aspects of gay culture that have nothing to do with illness. It seems to me that before 1969, homosexuality was pretty much treated as a medical problem. And one of the great triumphs of gay liberation was to demedicalize it. And now, because of AIDS, once again, every time the public thinks about gays, they think about AIDS. That is a medical problem. So, for instance, in the midst of all of the sadness of losing friends and lovers, I found reading Richard Ellman's biography of Oscar Wilde a wonderful inspiration, because here was a reminder of this towering figure who was this great cultural figure who was martyred, but for other political reasons, not for medical reasons. And I think that Genet is a similar figure. And I think that it's interesting to have these sort of beacons shining through what is a darker and darker night.
Well, you mentioned the dark night. I mean, that reminds me that your editor who asked you to write this biography, Bill Whitehead, died after you agreed to write the book. Your mother died while you wrote the book. Was it hard to write the book with that happening around you?
The book is dedicated to Hubert Sorin, who's my French lover who has AIDS and who's in a bad way, and to Bill Whitehead, who, after he commissioned it, did die. And, I think that part of my feeling was, well, why am I spending so much time on a biography that, after all, could be written by somebody else, whereas only I can write my fiction, whether it's good or bad. But on the other hand, I thought, I don't know, this is an interesting piece of work. I think I'm the right person to do it. I think it should be done now, because most of the people who knew Genet, especially those who knew him when he was young, are dying, and have many of them since died after I interviewed them. So it seemed to me very important to get all this down before it vanished.
Was it good for you to write something that wasn't coming just solely from within, you know?
Yeah, I found it an enormous relief, frankly, to not think about myself for a while.
Uh-huh.
I found it, and it's interesting, like, I'm not all that well known as a novelist in France, and so people just would leave me alone and let me do my work. But every once in a while I would go to England to give a reading and to talk about Genet, and people would suddenly say, but what about your own fiction? It would startle me, because I sort of forgotten about my own fiction. I was so absorbed in this project while working on it, so afraid I wouldn't finish it, so afraid, I mean, that I would get AIDS dementia and lose my memory, which, of course, is a nightmare for anybody, but especially for a biographer. I mean, I had so much information in my head, and I kept thinking, am I going to get it all down before I enter into some sort of mental decline? Anyway, it all got done, and I'm still in perfectly good health, even after 10 years of being positive.
That's really good to hear. That's very good to hear.
Thanks.
I want to get back to the process of writing the biography of Genet. One thing that you said someplace that really interested me is that it was much more difficult to interview people in France than it is to interview people in the United States. That you couldn't just pick up the phone and casually ask people intimate questions like you actually can do in the United States.
Absolutely. There's an entirely different attitude toward information, toward meeting people, and so on. In France, it's sort of like Japan. You have to always have an intermediary call for you and prepare the groundwork for you. And then later you call that person. And you have to sort of lay siege to somebody. The most extreme case of that was I wanted to interview a woman called Paul Thévenet. She was a good friend of Genet's during the 60s and helped him prepare the final script of the screens and was a very important witness for me. But she refused point blank to see me. So in my totally Machiavellian and creepy way, I hired an American girl for a year to pretend to take French lessons from this woman so that she could become friendly enough that she could then later introduce me to Paul. And then Paul and I became great friends, and I think she finally developed a lot of confidence in me and knew I was going to do a serious book, and she lived long enough to read it and to like it. But it's very, very hard to get French people to open up. And also with a subject like Genet, I mean, if you think of the usual literary biography is about a writer who was middle class, who grew up much photographed by his parents. Every little theme paper that he did in school was saved by his mother. All of his friends later turned out to be lawyers and doctors and have abundant memories of him and long lives in which to bear witness. Whereas Genet is not at all that kind of life, because the first half of his life is passed amongst the kind of people who are very hard to find. I mean, in other words, vagabonds, jailbirds, male prostitutes. I mean, this is a group of people who, alas, oftentimes die young or are hard to find mm-hmm. or melt away. If you do find them, they don't want to tell you anything. If they do tell you something, you're not sure you can believe it. I mean, it was very, very difficult to track all this stuff down.
You've written a series of two autobiographical novels, and they take you up to the period where you're a young man. Are you continuing this series? And if so, where are you in it?
Right. I wrote first A Boy's Own Story, which was about my adolescence, then The Beautiful Room Is Empty, which was about my 20s, and that ended with the Stonewall Uprising in 1969, the beginning of gay liberation. Now I'm continuing it with a book called The Farewell Symphony, which is about the 70s and the 80s, that is, the decade before and the decade after AIDS. And the title comes from the name of a Haydn symphony in which all the instrumentalists get up and leave the stage one after another, and there's only one violin left playing at the end, which is very much the feeling I have, having lost 50 or 60 of my closest friends, that is my whole generation in New York. For instance, I used to belong to a writer's club called the Violet Quill, and of the 8 original members, there are only 3 of us still living.
So does that mean you feel a certain responsibility to tell a story?
Yes, and a peculiar freedom. It's like nobody can contradict me because nobody's left
oh,
alive.
Gosh.
Yes, it is. I do feel a responsibility to talk. I mean, it's funny because now at age 53, I feel almost archaeological sometimes in my memories, because if I'll talk about the kind of wild times of the 70s, it seems very puzzling to young people today, who just feel it's almost mythical.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Edmund White is the author of Jean Genet, a biography. This week, it won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Best Biography of the Year. Our interview was recorded last November when the book was published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, one of America's most important folklorists, Alan Lomax. Lomax tells us about his early work traveling around the country with a portable record machine, documenting the work of blues and folk musicians. Among his most important recordings are the songs and stories of Woody Guthrie, Leadbelly, and Jelly Roll Morton. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Ben Stiller's new comedy, Reality Bites. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
So long, it's been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is a blowing me home. I've got to be rolling along.
The Woody Guthrie Library of Congress recordings preserved the songs and stories of one of America's most influential folk singers. The recordings were made by my guest, Alan Lomax. Lomax has devoted his life to the study of folk culture in America and around the world. His father, John Lomax, was one of the first popularizers of American folk songs. The father and son were the first folklorists to travel around the American South, recording songs on portable record machines. They both contributed thousands of field recordings to the Library of Congress's Archive of American Folk Song, which John Lomax founded in 1941. Alan Lomax went on to develop a system for measuring cultural differences in music and dance from around the world. For many years, he's directed a research project on the subject at Columbia University. This week, Alan Lomax won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction for his book The Land Where the Blues Began. So we're going to feature an interview with him from our archives, recorded in 1990. I asked Lomax about the technology he used when he first started making field recordings.
Actually, the first machine that my father and I took out was a Thomas Edison cylinder machine. And then the Library of Congress kindly replaced that with a disc machine that embossed the groove on an aluminum disc. For a long time, I was a media bug because I saw that the job of the folklorist was to make a bridge between people who had no voice and the big world of communication. And that's what I did for the first, half of my life, was simply run with a recording machine and record. Here in the West Indies, in Italy, in Spain, in Great Britain, and to encourage other people to do it and to publish the results, because this was the way that people could learn that other folks were out there just as interesting as they were. That's the first big lesson of the recording machine.
When you first started recording, you were a teenager and you were on the road with your father. What were your responsibilities in those very early days?
Well, basically, I ran the machine and lifted it and carried it. The whole thing weighed about 500 pounds, and I broke it down and put it in the back of our Ford, Model A Ford, often two or three times a day. It kept the fat off of me.
Were you interested in this, or were you just doing this to please your father when you were a teenager?
Well, no. I mean, I was an anthropologist in college and a radical, and I wanted to go along to see what was happening in the South. I'd been a Southern kid, and I knew my middle-class surround said, which was that blacks were perfectly content with their lot, was a lot of hooey. But I couldn't prove it because you couldn't get any information on the subject. There was nobody who was talking out of school. It was too dangerous. And so I went out to see what I could find out in the background of the recording sessions. And gradually, I began to learn how to get to know blacks, even though it was dangerous for them and to some extent for me.
You and your father were, I think, the first people to actually record in prison camps in the South. Why did you want to go there to record songs?
Well, there's always been an anomaly in the black community. all secular songs were considered sinful. Anything that wasn't religious was sinful. So that the whole of the secular, great secular song art of the black, the blues, the hollers, the work songs, all the casual songs of amusement were forbidden. You could be church. You could be kicked out of the church for singing them if you were a black person in a black, respectable black community. So that it was very difficult for us to get at this rich and unknown treasure trove of American music and lyricism without in the black, normal black community. People were scared to sing them, scared of criticism. So we decided to go where the devils were. I mean, the people who were beyond redemption. And we found them in the prisons, and we recorded a whole literature, which is still virtually unknown. Song bag of beautiful tunes, new kinds of melodies, and all sorts of things we found in the prison camps of the South. But the blacks were overjoyed to have a chance to do something, to let their problems be known, and because they had put tremendous a lot of their feelings and sorrows into these songs. They expressed the terrors of their existence.
I think the best known of the recordings that you made of prisoners was your recordings with Leadbelly, and you continued to record him after he got out.
Yeah, we did the first singer biography of him.
Let me play one of the recordings you made by Leadbelly, and this is Midnight Special. Would you like to say a few words about the circumstances under which you recorded it or the song itself? And you might want to tell us, too, how you met Leadbelly.
Well, Leadbelly had been in the Texas pen a couple of times, but we found him in the Louisiana penitentiary where prisoners were not allowed to sing in the fields, but they could have their own entertainers. And Leadbelly was a camp entertainer. He had his guitar there. And we went to camp number one, and when he heard we were there, he ran 100 yards from his cell to where we were, arrived without even breathing hard, and sat down and sang. Irene Goodnight was the first song he sang us, and he sang a song to appeal to the governor of Louisiana to let him out of there. His woman was mourning for him. And then he sang, among other things, the great Midnight Special, which is actually the song of the main theme song of the Texas Penitentiary, Let the Midnight Special Shine Its Ever-Loving Light on You. Think of prisoners who don't know whether they'll live through the next day, who are working from dawn in the morning till dark at night, who, if they fall afoul of a guard, may be beaten to death, hanging on the bars, absolutely stone-weary, wiped out, and watching the headlight of some onrushing train flash across the walls of their prison and into their faces. That's the mood of the song.
About an A-bar and the dress she wore, umbrella on the shoulder, feed the paper in her hand. Well, I'm going in at the governor, he's trying to lose them all, man. Let the midnight special shine your light on me. Let the midnight special shine a heaven-loving light on me. When I get up in the morning, when that big bell rings, over marching to the table, need the same old thing, not the talker on the table, there's nothing in my pants. Never said a thing about it, have trouble with the man, let the midnight special shine your light on me. Let the midnight special shine every loving light on me.
That's Leadbelly, and that was recorded by you and your father?
Well, I don't know. I've recorded it so many times with him, I don't know.
I see, okay,
which
right.
Recording was which.
When Leadbelly was released from prison, he traveled with your father for a couple of years, and your father put on a lot of concerts for him. Do you have any memories of what it was like for Leadbelly going from the South to the North and suddenly, like, performing for folklorists, for intellectuals, performing at Harvard University? Was there a period of culture shock and serious adaptation for him?
Not at all. He was just in triumph. In his mind, and it was true, he was the best in the world. He was the king of the 12-string guitar players in the world. He had a voice you could hear for a mile, an absolutely beautiful silvery tenor voice. It's never been heard, by the way. It's only on our first recordings. It began to go as he lived in the city.
My guest is folklorist Alan Lomax. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with folklorist Alan Lomax. I want to ask you about, I think, what's considered to be among the most important recordings you've ever made, and I'm thinking of the recordings you made with Jelly Roll Morton, the Library of Congress recordings, which features both him singing and playing, as well as talking about his life. How did you get to make those recordings with him?
Well, as I used a recording machine in the field, I began to discover that what an artist would say about the song at the end of a performance was usually psychologically and emotionally very revealing. And I began to record more and more of these codas to songs. And gradually, the codas began to stretch out longer and longer until I was recording whole life histories. And I had done a number of these by the time Jelly Roll came to the Library of Congress, anxious to prove to the world that jazz was not from Memphis, as Handy had said it was in a Billboard interview, but was from New Orleans. And Jelly Roll, an extraordinary intellectual he was, had the whole story worked out when he came to me in my office, which was backstage of the Coolidge Auditorium, the Library of Congress. On the stage was a grand piano. Around the hall, there were the busts of Bach and Beethoven. Jelly Roll sat down at the piano, completely at home with his peers, because he was, after all, our first literate native composer, and began to tell the story of jazz. Naturally, I was no great friend of jazz at the time, because jazz was what was driving folk music into obscurity, in my view. But this man was so fascinating that I thought I would try to find out how much, well, folklore there was in him. And within an hour, he'd said such wonderful things that I raced upstairs, got permission to work with him for a week and to use any number of discs to take down his life. That's how it all happened.
Let me play a short excerpt of the oral history that you recorded. Jelly Roll Morton is talking about when he started to play in the Tenderloin District in New Orleans.
In my younger days, I was brought in to the Tenderloin District by friends, young friends, of course. Even before we were in long pants, we used to steal long pants from around the fathers and brothers and uncles and so forth and so on.
Could you go down there before you had long pants on?
No, why, the policeman would run you right in jail, would run you ragged. Of course, we kids from time to time would climb those 8 and 10 feet high board fences. We'd really climb them and get away from these people, but they kept us right out of the district. They'd take the straps on the end of the clubs and just make switches out of them, cut our legs into ribbons, and was very frightened of, very much frightened. I happened to invade that section, one of the sections of the district where the birth of jazz originated.
Where was this? And how old were you?
At that time, that was the year of 1902. I was about 17 years old. I happened to go to Villeray and Bienville. At that time, one of the most famous night spots after everything was closed. It was only a back room where all the greatest pianists frequented after they got off from work. All the pianists got off from work in the sporting houses at around 4 or after, unless they had plenty of money involved. and they would go to this Frenchman's. That was the name of the place, saloon. And there would be everything in the line of hilarity there. They would have even millionaires to come to listen to the different great pianists, what would no doubt be their favorites maybe among them.
Jelleroe Morton, recorded by my guest Alan Lomax back in 1938. How do you think your role as folklorist has changed over the years? Or perhaps I should ask, how do you think the role of the folklorist has changed?
Well, so far as I'm concerned, I'm still doing the thing that I was inspired to do in my early recording sessions, when people would look at the microphone and say, "Mr. President, I want you to come down here and help us people where we are in our hard times in this place." And they looked at my father and myself as a channel to tell their troubles and to let their lives be known. That's what I've essentially tried to do all my life.
Alan Lomax, recorded in 1990. This week, his book, The Land Where the Blues Began, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction.
If you want to buy a home or farm that can't do nobody harm, or take your vacation by the mountains or sea, don't trade your old cow for a car. You better stay right where you are. You better take this little tip from me. 'Cause Governor Merriam on the radio one day, he jumped up to the microphone and he did say, "Oh, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, friends, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, you better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California's a Garden of Eden. It's a paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the do-re-mi."
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Guthrie.
Thank you, Mr. Lomax.
This record was made by the Department of Interior Radio Broadcasting Division on March the 21st, 1940. Alan Lomax speaking.
This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams from All Things Considered in Washington with a word about tonight's program. Dan Jansen wins a gold medal in Norway in the 1,000-meter skating race, winning in his last Olympic race. I'll talk with the reporter who saw this race, and we'll look ahead to the prospects for Bonnie Blair's skating races. I'll speak with a UN relief worker who's just left the Muslim enclave of Garajde. The food convoys have not been getting through. The area is surrounded by Serb forces. And we'll talk with the new captain of the only boat competing in the Whitbread Around the World sailing race that has an all-women crew. And Susan Stamberg says goodbye to the building where NPR has lived for the past 20 years. We are moving this weekend. That and other news coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Ben Stiller got his comedy genes from his parents, Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira. But his recent Fox TV comedy series, The Ben Stiller Show, proved that his style is all his own. Stiller is 28 now, and first-time screenwriter Helen Childress is 24. Together, they've made a movie about their generation called Reality Bites. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Is Generation X already old hat? Certainly, if you have your ear halfway to the rail, you've heard the term. And you know all about the 20-something kids it refers to, the slackers whose minds are filled with oily 70s TV shows and old commercial jingles. They don't have careers, they have McJobs. They wear grunge and listen to it. They eat junk and drink beer and stare listlessly into their future, which mostly doesn't exist. The central facts of their lives are the shrinking job market, the lowering of economic expectations, and the feeling that they've missed it. Missed the idealism of the 60s, missed the sexual revolution, missed the boom years. Reality Bites captures all this stuff almost too perfectly. The movie's reassuringly instructional. It's a Generation X primer, every 20-something joke, fear, and pop culture reference all crammed into one slick package. Fortunately, it's a pretty entertaining package as well. Our heroine is Lelena, played by Winona Ryder. She was her college valedictorian, and now she's working on a documentary about herself and her friends while failing at her first real job as a production assistant on a gooey TV morning show. She lives with her pal Vicky, who's working her way up as a sales clerk at The Gap. But now their charismatic college buddy Troy, played by Ethan Hawke, has lost his job at a newsstand and wants to move in with them. And as Troy hauls his stuff into the living room, Lelena registers her objections.
Vicky, he will turn this place into a den of slack.
What the hell is your problem?
I have to work around here, and unfortunately, Troy, you are a master at the art of time suckage.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, Miss Poster Girl, for the workers' party, but until I get that toehold in the burger industry, I got a little time to suck. I'd rather check into a shelter than deal with her.
Okay, I know how much you'd love to mainline your misery here, but you don't have to. I mean, I can get you a job interview at my dad's plant.
What is that, like part of my lease agreement?
It's either that or a credit check.
How much you like Reality Bites may depend on how much of that snappy repartee you can take. I, for one, went for it, especially as the sexual tension between Winona Ryder and Ethan Hawke developed into a full-scale romance, and especially when the director, Ben Stiller, showed up as a yuppie TV producer who falls hard for Lelena. Stiller makes him as sympathetic as he is synthetic. The other performances are just as good. Winona Ryder gives Lelena a genuine glow. Jane Ann Garofalo is wonderfully funny as her roommate Vicky, and as Troy, Ethan Hawke is something of a revelation. In movies like Dead Poets Society and A Midnight Clear, he seemed little more than a stolid pretty boy. But Hawke has been developing a lot doing stage work, and it shows. He gives Troy an edgy magnetism. Reality Bites gets lost about halfway through. As Lelena tries to choose between work and love and between the two men who adore her, the energy fizzles away. Still, this is a heartening film. You come away feeling that the talent here will last long after the Generation X cliches have gone the way of Gilligan's Island and the Brady Bunch.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, Audrey Voblaitis, and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, some answers to the questions, why would a young man shoot someone over an insult or hold up a McDonald's at gunpoint? Nathan McCall has done both, he's served time, and he's changed. He's now a reporter with the Washington Post and the author of a new memoir. We'll talk with him on the next Fresh Air.